Right.
Yeah, so as Dick mentioned, I'm going to be kind of switching gears a little bit here, going back to talking about the instrument and how Planck actually does its measurements of the cosmic microwave background. Well, first of all, thanks to the organizers for inviting me. This is a really cool conference. I'm glad to hear a lot of feedback and back and forth between the community and the Planck team. It's really helpful. So here I'm going to explain how the high-frequency instrument on Planck makes its measurements of the cosmic microwave background. In doing so, I want to highlight some very important systematic effects we've had to grapple with in doing the analysis. In particular, I'm going to talk about the optics, the cosmic ray hits in the bolometers on orbit, and some issues with the readout electronics that François already alluded to. And then, if I haven't scared you too much, I'm going to show a number of consistency tests at the end, which are very stringent, in fact, and show that despite some of these difficult systematics we've had to deal with, the HFI maps are really exceptionally good. And so you shouldn't worry. So this is my favorite picture of HFI. This is on the Planck spacecraft in French Guiana shortly before launch. Both instruments sit at the focal plane of the Planck telescope, and you can see both of them reflected in the primary mirror here. HFI sits in the middle of the focal plane. François already went over a lot of the numbers involving sensitivity and angular resolution. But I'll just mention that HFI is based on 52 bolometers operating at 0.1 Kelvin. The feed optics, each bolometer has its own separate feed optics, pieces of which are at different temperatures, 1.6 Kelvin and 4 Kelvin on the outside. I'll just mention again that one of the amazing technical successes of Planck was getting this cryogenic system to work. But the idea was to map the sky in six bands from 100 gigahertz to 857 gigahertz. There's polarization sensitivity from 100 to 353. I'm not going to talk about that at all. François already mentioned the excellent sensitivity of the maps that we've delivered. Start getting into the details, I'm going to talk about how HFI actually observes the sky. So as you probably know, the spin axis of Planck points away from the Earth, the Moon, and the Sun at all times. The satellite is rotating at 1 RPM. The main beams trace out nearly great circles on the sky. And as L2, as the Earth Moon L2 system orbits the Sun, the spin axis goes around, and you end up mapping the whole sky once every roughly 6 months. Now, the spin axis is not exactly in the anti-sun direction. It's allowed to precess slowly so that every detector can see the entire sky over the course of 6 months. The main beam is, of course, formed by these two reflectors in the focal plane. In addition, as I'll get more into this later, you worry about spillover as well, a far side lobe pickup. There's two main paths for far side lobe pickup. There's a path where the horns look directly over the top of the secondary mirror, and that gives some pickup that's about 10 degrees away from the main beam. And then there's another path where the horns look, after one reflection off the secondary mirror, over the top of the primary. That's close to the spin axis. So during one fixed pointing period, that primary spillover ends up pretty much falling on a nearly constant spot in the sky. So just as a schematic here to show you what the response as a function of the angle from the beam centroid is, this is a set of measurements made with planets of three different brightnesses to map out a lot of the dynamic range of the main beam. And then far out here is a model of the far side lobes. I'll get more into that later. But the main point is that the main beam features are most of the response coming from this main beam lobe. You have a little bit of a shoulder. And then at very far angles, the spillover contributes something like 10 to the minus 10 of the response at the peak. So this is our first important systematic effect. And the reason is that it's sort of an obvious culprit, potential culprit, for our discrepancy with WMAP. Chris did a really nice job of explaining this discrepancy in detail, so I won't dwell on it too much, other than to point out that that there's an excellent agreement between HFI and LFI as compared to the agreement between Planck and WMAP. So I'm going to talk about the optics of HFI, but if some systematic in the optics is to explain this discrepancy with WMAP, it'd have to be some coincidence where in LFI's analysis the same kind of effect would have to appear, and so that's a point for you guys to remember. Okay, so this is our beam. Our main beams are measured using Mars observations. Now, of course, what you want to do with your beam maps is to actually correct your angular power spectra. We calculate what are called effective beams. This is essentially the angular response to the sky for a given pixel in the map. And so this has to come from a combination of the beam map made on Mars with the scan history of Planck. And so this effective beam varies a bit over the sky. You can see near the ecliptic poles, for example, Duncan showed a similar plot. I don't know if you can read the labels here, but this is the beam ellipticity going from about 1.01 to 1.2. And you can see near the ecliptic poles where you've scanned at a whole bunch of different angles that ellipticity washes out a bit. So then once you have the effective beams, you can calculate the correction you want to make to your angular power spectrum, which we call the effective beam window function. So this is what it looks like plotted on a log scale for all six HFI bands. The gray bands here are one sigma error bars, which come from simulated observations of Mars. By the way, the dotted lines are a best fit Gaussian effective beam window function. So you can see that especially at 143 gigahertz, the beams are actually quite symmetric and fairly close to being described by a Gaussian shape. So those errors, if you've tried to look at the beam errors in the Planck legacy archive, you'll see that they're described by the set of eigenmodes. The simulated observations of Mars were decomposed into principal components, which account for almost all the variance, something like 99% in five modes. Because of course the beam errors are highly correlated across multipole space. So we do some internal consistency checks on the angular power spectra obtained from different detectors. This is at all the detector sets at 143 gigahertz. The gray is the error estimated from the Mars error analysis. And you can see that these relative beams and relative calibration factors agree really well. Okay, so now what you worry about if you're interested in trying to find some reason for a several percent discrepancy at degree scales is some kind of degree scale feature in the beam. And this is certainly physically motivated. If you have RMS surface errors on the reflector surfaces, you can get scattering of power into wider angles than you'd expect just from just in the main lobes. So what we do is look at Jupiter data, which we see with extremely high signal to noise. We actually don't use Jupiter for our main beam maps because it tends to drive the detectors into the nonlinear regime near the peak. But the side lobe structure stays well within the linear regime, and then we can correctly scale this side lobe structure by comparing the Jupiter data to dimmer planet data. So the first thing that sort of jumps out at you, the axes here, this is the cross-scan direction in arcminutes, and this is the co-scan. So this is actually a 12-degree by 2-degree plot. The first thing that you notice probably is this long tail, and that comes from an incomplete deconvolution of the bolometer and electronics transfer function, which have a finite response time. You have to measure and deconvolve. We know that transfer function extremely well, but we still see a little bit of residuals. And so the color scale is in dB, so this residual tail is effectively something like at the few 10 to the minus 4 level. So that's very small. Also, if you integrate that tail to determine how much of the total solid angle of the beam is in that tail, it comes out to 10 to the minus 4 level effect. So orders of magnitude less than what you would need to get a few percent discrepancy. So then the wide angle scattering effect that I mentioned, you can actually detect, and that's this sort of fuzzy blob that you see pretty clearly at 353 gigahertz and up. It's fairly large. It extends out 30, 40 arc minutes, but it's down at the 40 dB level again. Because it's so large, it actually does contribute a larger fraction of the solid angle, and I'll show that in more detail in the next slide. Another thing that you might notice are these sort of discrete features. That's kind of an interesting effect of the telescope backing structure. So you see some, you actually get a diffraction grating effect because you have different hexagonal, the hexagonal backing structure effectively gives you panels of the zones of the mirrors, which are highly correlated across that panel. And you get diffraction lobes in several different directions. The other thing is you might wonder why in some cases you see a tail going in both directions. That actually has to do with our deconvolution of this transfer function in the Fourier domain and a low-pass filter we apply. You actually get some acausal ringing that's kind of ahead of the observation of the planet. But again, this is even smaller than the residual transfer function tail that's behind the observed planet. Whoops, wrong way. So another way to look at these near side lobe effects is to actually do an azimuthal binning of the Jupiter data and get a radial profile. Then you can pretty clearly see this kind of shoulder that you could see in the 2D plots before. Now you have a even higher signal to noise measurement of it, and you can integrate it up. And typically, you get something that's less than 0.2% of the total beam solid angle. So this is too small to explain this discrepancy with WMAP. Now it is actually to think about this in angular power spectrum space. Shown here are the biases in the window function due to several different systematic effects as compared to the quoted error bars in the beam window function. The green curve is the window function bias due to a near side lobe. That's unaccounted, that's at this level. And you can see that it's largish compared to the errors, but not at the percent level, as I said. Okay, now another effect is that I mentioned earlier on is the response of the system to power coming from more than 5 degrees away from the main lobe. This can cause a number of problems. Of course, you don't want to pick up galaxy when you're trying to look away from the galaxy and so on. But it can also, again, bias your measurement of the effective beam window function. So we have a hard time measuring this effect, actually. It's so low. I showed you what a physical optics model predicts. If you integrate that model up, even though the level is like 10 to the minus 10, it covers such a huge fraction of the sky, it integrates up to something like 0.3% of the total beam solid angle. So that's a model. We don't actually detect it except at 857 gigahertz. I'll get to this later. The only way we can do this is by looking at survey differences. And in fact, we see nothing in CMB channels. So our line right now is that even though we don't see the far side lobes, and we have to rely on physical optics models to predict what they say, we don't think the physical optics models are off by orders of magnitude, or else we would detect something. Another thing you'll hear from LFI, the description of LFI later in the week from Peter Meinhold, they can detect their side lobes at very low frequency, and it agrees extremely well with their physical optics model. So we have some confidence that the physical optics actually works and sets a reasonable limit. Nothing. This again tells us that there's nothing in this beam analysis that can explain the 2.5 discrepancy in power. So as Chris said, as of now, it's still a mystery. But I just wanted to go through the beam, different parts of the beam in detail to show you that we've really tried to dig into that. Now I'm going to move on to talk about the bolometers. So you've defined your beams, the part of the sky you're looking at using your optics. The light goes down and is detected by bolometers, which were built at JPL. These are so-called spider web bolometers, which have a very low filling factor. They're a metallized grid of silicon nitride that is sensitive to millimeter wave radiation, but other potentially heating effects such as cosmic rays are supposed to pass right through. You'll see that that's not entirely the case in a minute, but it's a really good thing we went with this design anyway. We also have to look at polarization, polarization-sensitive bolometer pairs, which are two of these bolometers that are mounted in the same horn, very close together, each of which is metallized only in one direction so that it's sensitive to a single sense of polarization. This is kind of the pinnacle of the semiconductor bolometer technology, I would say. It has a very long heritage from many suborbital missions that many of us are familiar with. So when we actually were looking at the data, you probably, some of you you're used to staring at data, may have been a little shocked by what Francois showed earlier too. You look at the time stream, this is about 2.5 minutes. You can see as we spin, you see the CMB dipole nicely, you see the galaxy, this is 143 gigahertz, 545 and a dark bolometer in case you can't read the axes. But you also see this kind of hair on top. And this is a big problem, in fact. This is leads us to our next important systematic, and that's the cosmic ray hit rate is much higher than was expected. So bolometers are thermal sensors of radiation, so they detect anything that deposits heat in them, including galactic particles. we know that these spikes in the data actually come from particle hits, because the rate is extremely correlated in time. So that's the black is the glitch rate in HFI. It's correlated in time with onboard particle sensors, which are used in spacecraft operations to make sure you don't have a big solar storm coming or something like that. And also another interesting fact is you can see that over time, this is over the whole mission of HFI, the glitch rate declined. And this actually is anti-correlated with the number of sunspots. It's anti-correlated with the solar activity, which is at first kind of a little counterintuitive. And actually late in the mission, as the sun started waking up, you start to see these big spikes in the onboard particle counters, which correspond with solar storms. So actually what we think we're seeing is low energy galactic particles, which normally are blocked by the solar activity. Actually, at the time of designing HFI, this low energy tail of galactic cosmic rays wasn't understood incredibly well. So we didn't anticipate that in the design. This is the kind of thing we see in the data. So these events are called glitches because they essentially create transients in the data, a period of which is unusable. There's three different types, these so-called short glitches, which have a profile that looks like this blue curve here, that they decay really rapidly. And these are actually at a hit rate that was pretty much as expected before launch. Now, what we're dominated by, though, are this is actually log scale here. So most of the hits we see are from these so-called long glitches. And they're called long because they have this very long transient tail that stretches out. You can see it a second later in some cases. And this is really annoying because at a hit rate of 1 to 2 per second, that means essentially every data sample is touched by one of these cosmic ray tails. Then at an even lower rate, we have these other events that have a slow rise time. It's a little hard to see here. And they have a very slow decay. So our understanding is the short glitches are particles that directly impact the grid or the thermometer and the bolometer. So that's as expected. These long glitches are actually particles that impact the silicon wafer structure that supports the bolometers. We know that in a number of ways. The hits are highly correlated between PSBs in the same horn, for example. So you have cosmic rays which pass through both silicon frames and deposit energy in both bolometers. So basically, the reason our hit rate was high is partly because we didn't anticipate this very low energy tail of galactic cosmic rays, and also because we didn't take into account hits in the silicon wafer. So I should just point out that it's possible, we have existence proof already, that you can avoid this for future space missions. The example is in Herschel, which has similar technology, but it has many bolometers mounted in one large silicon frame, and they don't see a high cosmic ray hit rate. And that's just because there's essentially better thermal heat sinking. So you can basically do a better thermal design job now that we know these are out there in the future. So in terms of the data, though, what we end up doing is flagging this fast transient peak. We actually do a template fit to every single glitch event, which is literally billions, and we subtract this long tail from the data. So in the end, we end up flagging only, on average, 15%, 15 to 20% of the data, declines down to 10 to 15% by the end of the mission. This has a number of interesting effects, this glitch tail subtraction. So this is a noise spectrum of all the HFI bolometers at 143 gigahertz. So this is actually in, this is basically a PSD of the noise, of the time order data. These dark curves are the noise you get before subtracting these tails. The red curves are what you get after subtraction. So you can see, and this is a log plot, so you can see you get a really huge improvement, the lower frequency noise, after taking these tails out. Essentially, these glitch tails were creating time-correlated noise in the data. Now, just to orient you a little bit, this green line shows the spin frequency. So anything below that is effectively removed by map making. The bandwidth you care about is anything higher than that green line in frequency.
Hey,
Yeah, I think that's a little hard to tell because as far as I know, we don't see anything with the rotation phase of the spacecraft. And then with time, as we go around the solar system and are pointing in different directions, it's really hard to separate any effects you would see due to where you're pointing from this solar activity modulation. So I don't think we can really say. Yeah, but right. But the problem is the dominant effect seems to be correlated with the anti-correlated with the solar activity. So it's a little hard to say 6 months later, what happened. The sun probably woke up rather than cosmic ray flux changed. So there is an interesting effect pointed out. There's a little bit of correlated noise if you do a cross power spectrum of the time order data. This is in black, you have the auto spectra of all 800 gigahertz polarization sensitive bolometers. In blue are cross spectra of PSBs that are in the same horn. Now, like I said, we see a very high coincidence rate between the PSBs in the same horn. And we flag all the glitches we can see, but it seems that there are some tails left in the data that are correlated between the PSBs but are not removed by the template fitting. So that's an interesting point. Now, just to point out, after deglitching, we have a procedure that looks that this procedure I described works extremely well. The timelines look a lot cleaner. These little magenta points show the number of flagged samples, which is quite a few. Now, as I mentioned, nearly every single data sample is touched by this process. But we've done simulations that convince us that any bias to signal on the sky is at less than 5 × 10⁻⁴ on all angular scales. So we think we're okay. Another interesting point is that the noise looks very Gaussian after deglitching. Black is a histogram of a detector sample, and purple is a symmetrized version of that. And so, if you had a significant population of glitches remaining, you would see a significant bias in one direction. So anyway, it looks very good. 1 minute left. Okay, so the last interesting the point I wanted to get to is in the calibration of HFI. So for that, we use the WMAP-7 solar dipole for the CMB-sensitive channels for 100 to 353 gigahertz. The higher frequencies, we use Uranus and Neptune. We actually see the orbital dipole. That's the modulation of the dipole due to Planck's motion around the sun. But so far, we haven't used it to calibrate it. So the interesting thing from this is that, as I showed, you see the dipole with very high signal-to-noise in the CMB channel, so you can actually do a very good fit, pointing period to pointing period. So you can measure the calibration as a function of time. And what we actually found was a kind of significant variation of the gain as a function of time. This took us a very long time to figure out, because we would see effects like this where there'd be kind of a big jump in the data that didn't seem, a big jump in the calibration that didn't seem to correlate with any onboard event. It didn't correlate bolometer to bolometer necessarily, but sometimes it did. Eventually, though, we tracked it down to non-linearity in the ADC converters, which read out the bolometer voltage, that convert the bolometer voltage into a digital signal to send down to Earth. So just to explain this a little bit, we use a 16-bit A to D converter for each detector. all of these ADCs have nonlinearity in them. Usually what you do is you match your signal so that it covers a huge amount of your ADC, so that any nonlinearity from bit to bit sort of gets washed out. In the case of Planck, though, we had to handle a huge dynamic range in the ADC. So we had to both be able to handle giant galactic signals as well as CMB signals. So the CMB signals, the anisotropy, are at the level of a few digits in the ADC. The dipole is of order 50 digits. So you can imagine, as we're scanning on the dipole, the voltage is being digitized. You have this bit error. Some offset voltage in the electronics drifts around, the heating of the bolometer slowly drifts with time, you can actually jump across pretty big transitions here. And so that's what leads to these funny jumps and this strange strange kind of behavior. So what we're doing is we've actually measured this nonlinearity. Basically, you want some kind of lookup table like this to correct your data. So we've measured that on orbit, in fact. One issue is that that's not really enough in the case of HFI, because there's digital lock-in done on board. So you don't a priori know which ADC digits went into the single sample you have on the ground. So you have to do some modeling as well. So that's ongoing work. So our solution for the current delivery was to actually solve for this, treat it as a time-varying gain, which it's not really, as Francois already mentioned. It actually can distort the dipole a little bit, add harmonics. But it works very well. Just to show you that this is a plot in the calibration paper showing for a single detector, this is the difference between survey 3 and survey 1. So you should see exactly the same sky. With no time variable gain fit, you see kind of residual dipole, residual galaxy leaking through. After you do the time variable gain fit, it cleans up quite a bit. Okay, so I'm out of time, but I don't want to leave you with these scary things. I'm going to quickly talk about the null test we did to check the data quality. So Francois already mentioned the number of levels of redundancy we have in our scan strategy. And in fact, we've delivered maps that are split along these lines. You have the first half of each pointing period, the second half of each pointing period, which we call first and last maps. Then we also have the single survey maps. So these should show identical sky structure to within the noise. So this is just a plot of what you see if you look at the first half of each pointing period minus the second half. It's very consistent with noise. You see some structure in the near the galaxy, and that has to do with exactly where you have regions of high signal gradient, where each of your samples falls within a pixel or on that structure exactly tends to matter quite a bit. So you can actually see some signal leaking through. You can see a little bit of striping as well. That's just from some of this low frequency noise. But these are extremely clean. Note the 5 microK scale for the 100 through 217, which is really the where we're interested in and for the purposes of the CMB. Now, the survey differences are actually our most stringent kind of test we can do. This is because we see the same sky, but the spacecraft is on opposite sides of the solar system. It's scanning the sky at a different angle than in each survey. So you're sensitive to a lot of different systematics in this. Any beam asymmetries show up pretty strongly in the galactic plane. And you can, I think some of this is from beam asymmetry. Any errors you've made in deconvolving your electronics and bolometer transfer function can show up more clearly here, and so on. Another very interesting thing we see that hasn't really been mentioned much yet is what you see at high frequencies and is aligned with the ecliptic, and that's actually zodiacal dust, because on different sides of the solar system, you're actually looking through different optical depths of the zodiacal dust cloud. So that's actually fairly bright in our highest frequency maps, and you can even you can see it pretty well at 353 gigahertz even, and even potentially at 217 as well. So that's kind of interesting find. Now getting back to the far side lobes, we actually identify these structures in our 857 gigahertz maps as pickup from the center of the galaxy by that far side lobe path, which is roughly aligned with the spin axis. So that is our pretty much our only measurement on the sky of our far side lobes. Now at 857 gigahertz, it's very hard to do physical optics modeling for a number of reasons. Also, we see an interesting variation from bolometer to bolometer in this far side lobe pickup. But it, at least it appears in kind of the right place and can give us a little bit of constraint on what we think our far side lobes are. Okay, and so then just to try to be a little more quantitative about these difference maps at the very end here, this is an angular power spectrum of the difference maps at 353 and down. Dashed lines are the survey difference, dotted the solid lines are the first half of pointing period minus second half of pointing period. There's more structure in the survey differences, but the scale is extremely small. And in fact, if you do a real statistical null test here, basically do power spectra with a galactic mask applied, and compare that with simulations to try to get error bars, you find that in general, you get an extremely small signal for 100 through 217. The red points are the power spectra of the survey difference maps, binned the same way as the power spectra that go into the likelihood. The black line here is the cosmic variance error bars. So you can see that these any power that's in these survey differences is extremely tiny compared to cosmic variance. In fact, if you then look at this is the same plot on a log scale, so you can see the low L points. There actually is a significant failure of this null test. I haven't put down chi-squares because they're not necessarily good, but I don't think that's actually a problem, because if you look at the level of this failure, it's at the level of a few tenths of a micro-K. So we think that the maps are extremely good from that point of view. So yeah, just to wrap up, we think the maps are of exceptionally good quality. We had a couple of systematic challenges to handle, but we think in the end, our null tests show that that's not a problem. The significant angular power spectrum discrepancy with WMAP, that Chris discussed in detail, has to be understood at some point. I think the beams are pretty well ruled out on the HFI side, at least. Expect a lot more from HFI in the future. The polarization maps and measurements are to be delivered next year. So thanks.
Sorry, I apologize for this basically remedial question, which will be a yes-no question. Is it totally clear that this distinction with WMAP that's not understood could not affect things like the tilt? I mean, I think we might have heard in one talk that it could be L dependent.
Right. I think someone like Joe is better equipped to answer that, but it doesn't seem like it does. You heard from Chris that there's some disagreement within the team as to whether it's a constant offset or has some structure. So the point is it's close to being a constant, no matter which way you see it. So I don't think it affects the tilt.
Well, how close to constant?
So I think we don't know for sure because we don't know the shape of the difference. What we can say, though, is if we just take the L range probe by Planck and compare parameters from that L range to the WMAP ones, they're in good agreement, which says something about it not affecting parameters very much. If you cut Planck at L of 1,000, the parameters then, including the tilt, for example, that's right, but the other parameters do agree, so it doesn't seem to be filtering in. But that doesn't say that we're kind of home free.
So about the beam?
Yeah.
So if I understood it correctly, you have a far side lobe which is modeled, and you know that's about 0.3%, but which you don't include in the beam.
That's right.
And side lobe, you actually have 0.2%, which is known, but you also don't include.
That's correct.
So that's 0.5%.
Yep.
And if you square it, or if you double it, that's 1%.
Right.
So are you then saying that Planck power spring should have been greater by 1%? Right? So the real discrepancy isn't 2.5%, right. It's actually 1.5%.
Well,
right?
Okay. I think the 0.2% from the near side lobes, you're right. I think that should bump up the power by something like 0.4%. The far side lobes is a more difficult question to answer because it also biases the calibration. And it depends, you know, I showed you the two main optical paths. One of those is very far from the spin axis. It doesn't really bias the calibration. Mm-hmm. The other does. So I think the details of that far side lobe pattern actually matter a bit more. I think it's a little hard to say that it biases, you know, the power spectrum should go up by 0.6%. I don't think we know that yet.
Okay. But it sounds like, I mean, of course, each one of the items you mentioned is too small. Each one of the items, like a near side lobe, far side lobe, other things, mm-hmm. individually, of course, they're too small, but they kind of add up. And
sure, yeah.
So it's not, it sounds like you do have some significant function. And of course, yeah. Our formal error in the beam is 0.6%, which is not negligible fraction of 2.5%. Mm-hmm. So right. In the end, if you know, bits and pieces, they add up and.
Yeah, I mean, I guess the point where we are now is that the error budget we have now for the beams comes nowhere near 2.5% in power. It would be a pretty big stretch at this point. I mean, we can't think of anything that would.
Yeah, but I'd like to understand what I just said, right? So if this 0.3% in far side lobe actually is there, mm-hmm. The calibration doesn't do anything. Then far side lobe plus, because they add up, right? It's not like random
right,
noise.
But then you're still missing another 1.5%.
Well, but the doubling up noise, the beam is known to only 0.6% in power.
In power, yeah.
So then the difference
closer,
is now 0.9%. It helps. But it goes in the right direction in some sense, yeah? So this coupling to calibration is interesting. I haven't thought of it.
Right. Yeah.
Gary, it seemed that there was as you are pointing out, there is not a single solution where you can sort of say, oh, it's obvious. I mean, this is what you have to call for is maybe a series of things piling on the top of each other. And what we ended up this discussion with was that, well, there is just not a single culprit and we've got to work on it and we don't have the final answer. And that's what we have been telling you several times. We've looked at every single effect on our side, and there is no way we can explain it just on our side.
Decrease the level.
You say it again so that everybody can hear?
There is a part of the far side lobe effect which is removed by the destriper.
Right, that's the part of the far side lobe that's pretty much points along the spin axis. It's roughly a constant per pointing period, so it ends up being removed by the map making. Yep.
I'm not sure if this is a question for you, Brendan, but in the power spectrum paper, the effects of filtering and FL are ignored. So I'm just wondering, given all the filtering that you did, what are the prospects for figuring that out, and could that also affect somehow the connection with WMAP? Or?
Well, I can mention a little bit of the filtering we did. The main filter we applied to the data, the time-ordered data, was to deconvolve the bolometer and electronics transfer function. And we also apply a low-pass filter at high frequency to regularize that, because, of course, the transfer function, because the bolometer has a finite response time, that transfer function drops off at high frequency. But that's very far out of our signal band, and any effects of that filter end up getting put into our beam because we spin at roughly a constant spin rate. So the spacecraft spins at 1 RPM, and that spin rate is constant to something like 0.1%. So any errors in the transfer function deconvolution end up effectively as part of the beam map.
Didn't you notch out some lines from the fridge, and also you have all the cosmic ray filtering that I mean I don't know if that would
So I mentioned what we think the effects of the cosmic ray template removal is on the signal. You can look at plots in the glitch paper, but yeah, on all scales we think it's less than 5 × 10⁻⁴ effect. In terms of there are notch filters. So I didn't mention pickup we see in the HFI data from the 4 Kelvin cooler. It appears at very specific frequencies in our signal band. And actually, you could, if you were paying close attention, you could have seen it in some of my plots of the noise. The noise spectra I was showing with the deglitching show this line. There's an example right there. So 10 hertz in harmonics, essentially. So, but those are extremely localized. I mean, the bias of the bolometers is phase locked to the drive of the cooler. So they're very local in frequency in the time domain, and as such, they should be very local in multipole space as well. I mean, so yeah, even though we didn't take that into account, it should be extremely narrow band.
Do you project out the signal before deglitching, or is the signal part of the fit?
We take out an estimate of the signal.
Okay.
Yeah, could you just explain?
Right.
How do you get that number 10⁻⁴, you said, after the error from deglitching in the map space? Because that's a pretty big jump you got there, and that's equivalent to scales in the sky around 100, 200, right? So
well, this is the dipole, and each of these, you can see each of these dips shows harmonics.
No, but the overall correction from the subtraction of the glitching down to your 1/F. So the residual error, the confidence with which you think you've done that correction, results in 10⁻⁴ in map. Okay,
yep.
So the error on that 1/F tail is tiny.
Yep. So yeah, we do that using simulations where we inject a population of glitches with the energy spectrum that we've now measured really well, and remove them using the algorithm that we described, and then look at what happens to the signal in that simulation.
That's
where we get the four.
Presumably, this is uncorrelated in LFI. So.
Right. Right.
So that is.
Yep. Right. Remember, the glitch rate does significantly change over the course of the mission, too. So this survey difference actually probes that to some extent as well.
So coming back to ADC nonlinearities, I guess that must affect beam also to some extent, because
right.
Yeah, so how do you actually take into account?
Well, so far we use simulated Mars measurements where we put it through a model of the ADC to put a limit on that effect. And actually, one of the curves in this plot that I showed that I didn't describe actually shows that effect. It's tricky because it's nonlinear, right? So we're not.
Change the shape.
Yeah, it changes the shape, and it's really strongly dependent on the signal amplitude. So it's not clear, you know, given, so let me see if I can describe this. So yeah, you have some ADC correction that you want to apply to your CMB data, and you also want to apply the right correction to your beam data as well. And since the dynamic range is so different, it's kind of tricky to match that up properly. So I didn't really want to get into that, but yeah, it is. It's definitely a worry, and that goes along with the ADC correction that we're working on now.
You have some estimate for the upper bound on the effect?
Well, in the paper, this is what we put in there. This is the magenta curve shown here. So.
Oh, that's the potential error due to ADC.
And again,
okay.
This is the best estimate. Mm-hmm. We're not, I don't know.
Mm-hmm.
No.
Sure.
Takes this into account partially, so we cannot do this completely straightforwardly.
Yeah.
So this is our best estimate as of today.
Yeah. Yeah. Right.
So we
at least in terms of the beam. The ADC correction, the ADC issue. Yeah.
So we're told that 5:30 is our cutoff point. So if there are no other burning questions that can't be asked over a beer or some such thing, okay, then I thought it was a great session, and my fellow Plankians did a great job today, and I think they deserve a round of applause.